David Braben was 17 when he wrote Elite. He had just gone to work for Acorn Computers in Cambridge, and they gave him a brand new model of their new computer to do his programming on. It was the BBC Micro, so called because Acorn had built it to go along with a series on BBC television about computing. Every week in early 1982, during the early days of home video, hundreds of thousands of people plugged in the flat beige box, turned on their TV, and received instruction in the ways of the microcomputing revolution, cassette tape recorder and all.
We have a program in there and we can put it into the machine.
Well, let's do it. All right, so far so good. There's a perfectly ordinary domestic cassette recorder.
Exactly.
Okay, connected to this. Now, what happens next?
Well, we have to load the program into the machine. So you type load.
L-O-A-D.
Now, we've got to give it the name of the program. So in this particular machine, we have to use quotation marks to give it the name. So quotation marks, and the name of the game is Wall. It's the old Wall game.
Right.
Now, we must switch on the cassette.
Yes.
And then hit return. And that puts the control back to the computer. And now it's beginning
searching.
To search.
Right. Now, presumably, as you said, this is a fairly slow and laborious way of doing it. And we could speed things up by...
At the end of the episode, a piece of software will be broadcast in the form of a painful audio howl, which viewers could capture on a cassette tape and play back later for their computers to digest. Compared with the computers of the present, the BBC Micro was extraordinarily primitive. You can't even think of it as a dinosaur. That title should be reserved for Apple's first Macintosh. At that point, only a twinkle in a designer's eye over in California. Or for the green-screened Amstrad PCW a few years later, which first converted many of us to the delights of word processing.
To start with, you were expected to have plug in a cassette recorder, and there was this, you had this very, very long wait while you waited for the files to go in, and similarly for the files to go out. Power cut was a bit disastrous. So programming it was a fraught activity. But pretty soon, fortunately, because of Acorn, we were able to have a disk drive,
Whoa.
Which then was seen as a mighty... It was an expensive piece of kit.
Do you remember the prices at all?
Yes. I vaguely remember that the disk drive that we used to program Elite was something like £800. Bearing in mind the machine was £400, you get an idea of the fancy piece of technology it was. It was actually a dual disk drive, and you could put in two discs, but considering the cost of floppies today, where you're talking less than £10 for the drive, and the modern floppy drives are far better than the ones that were around then.
On the other hand, the speed of data take-up compared to an audio cassette take must have been amazing.
It was wonderful. You could also load files without user interaction. You don't have to rewind the tape. It would do it all by itself. That was wonderful as well.
In computing terms, the BBC Micro was more like the first clumsy four-legged organism to creep out of the sea and peer around at its new environment. It didn't make the screen into a picture of a desktop, so everything had to be done by typing in text commands. It had no mouse, and its total working memory, after all the demands of the system itself had been taken care of, was 20K, about enough to store a two-page memo in a modern office PC. But at the time, it was the hottest thing on the market. To a young man with a bright idea, it was revolutionary, it was sleek, it was thrilling, and all the promise of the future was concentrated under its beige lid.
She's a model and she's looking good. I'd like to take her home, that's understood.
Part of its beauty was definitely the simplicity. It was practical in a relatively quick time to get a reasonable familiarity with everything that was going on under the lid. Compared to today's system, it was very, very simple. But also, you know, simplicity means that it's much more usable. You don't feel that nasty things are going on in the background, and you have control of the little bits, or at least knowledge of or expectation of why things will behave the way they do.
You could use the BBC Micro to display little animations. You could arrange straight lines according to the ancient laws of perspective to hint at depth and distance. In other words, it was just possible to begin to treat the computer screen as a window onto an artificial world. David Braben was ambitious. He wanted to fit whole planets, whole solar systems, whole sets of solar systems into those 20K. Ingenious mathematical compression did some of the work, but extra assistance came from the glorious uniformity of the boxes shipped out into viewer land.
The other factors were that all of the BBC micros out there were, to all intents and purposes, identical. So you could afford to use up every last byte. It's not like some of them have a few hundred extra bytes, a few have a few hundred less. There's a terrible tendency these days with software that as it bloats bigger and bigger, you can just say, oh, well, we'll just raise the minimum spec because you've got this continuum of different specification computers. With the BBC Micro, it either worked on that machine, which would be the same as the one that person was playing it that who'd gone out and bought it from the shop. It would be the same as the one you've tested it on, which is wonderful. And I think this is why more recent game consoles like PlayStation have succeeded so well.
At the consumer's end, too, the BBC Micro was a success. Somehow the association with the BBC gave the machine a deeply reassuring pedigree. This seemed to be computing provided by an unimpeachably respectable organisation. Computing brought to viewers almost as a new kind of public service. The object itself was reassuringly solid. The tough metal case, the black and red keyboard with real three-dimensional typewriter-like keys, the Perspex strip along the top bearing the logo of a digitised owl. It seemed to be built to last. And in fact, it did. There was an attested case of one running for 9 years straight without being turned off. The Science Museum in London still uses them to power some of its interactive displays. By the mid-1980s, the BBC Micro was riding high, and Acorn Computers, as its manufacturer, dominated the British market. Schools, especially, hardly used anything else. Herman Hauser was the managing director of Acorn.
It became the standard computer in British schools, and a whole generation of British school children was reared on BBC micros, and I often bump into people who say that this was my first computer. And at that time, it also made Britain the most computer-literate nation in the world. We had more computers in schools than any other nation.
This doesn't sound like a portrait of a medium that's about to die. The truth is that a piece of technology doesn't necessarily get pushed out of the market because something obviously superior came along. If that were so, the world would be a very tidy place and every change would be for the better. But a sizable fraction of media deaths happened by accident, because of the fog of uncertainty that hides the true state of the market at any particular moment, just as the fog of war hides the true position on a battlefield from a general. The fog of the marketplace prevented Acorn from seeing that each of the good qualities David Braben just named were, from another angle, symptoms of trouble to come. The BBC Micro was simple, because it was built entirely by one company. You could guarantee that every user had an identical box of tricks, because it was built entirely by one company. But it wasn't a platform that other computer companies could develop, because it was built entirely by one company. It didn't take off around the world, because... But you know the rest. The link with broadcasting that gave it privileged access to hearts and minds in Britain could not be extended beyond the magic kingdom where Auntie reigned. Herman Hauser.
One of the interesting lessons that we learned from Acorn is that, first of all, this is a global game, not just a UK market. And indeed, dominating the UK market, as we did in computers, there were more BBC and Acorn computers sold in Britain than any other brand. At the time, we had something like 60% of the PC market, as it was later known. But dominating a market as large as the UK market, or as it turns out, as small as the UK market, is just not important. So this is a global market, and global standards are very important. And we just did not understand, as many people find hard to understand, that a better technical solution, which we had at the time, would not win out.
And so, as the 1980s went on, the IBM personal computer became the standard architecture for 90% of the desktop machines on the planet. and Microsoft began its long march from being an obscure Seattle software company to being the colossus that bestrides the world. Acorn didn't die. It transmogrified in the 90s into a microchip design powerhouse. But the BBC Micro did, as David Braben recounts.
What happened to the BBC Micro was it was a great machine in Britain. It was a good machine in Europe, but there weren't very many of them, and it never really made it into the States. Gradually, the software business became more global, and that was a factor against the BBC Micro, partly because, you know, if a games company was going to do a game, BBC Micro was not a major platform in that sense. Elite was the only real game that did big numbers on the BBC Micro.
Herman Hauser is a venture capitalist now. If he looks back at the intellectual assets Acorn had at its height and acts as management consultant to his younger self, he sees a product that cried out to be licensed so that it could spread beyond Britain.
With hindsight, you could argue that the BBC microcomputer at the time was clearly the best hardware because the other leading architecture was the Apple II, and we were a factor of two, which is very considerable, a factor of two better than the Apple II. We had a processor that ran twice as fast, we had twice the screen resolution, we had color, the Apple II didn't, and we had something that nobody had at the time, which was a network connection. We never sold any computers at Acorn Computers without network connections, and that turned out to be very important. So you might well ask, why is the world Intel and Microsoft compatible rather than Acorn compatible? And the answer, of course, was that a standard emerged around Microsoft that incorporated lots and lots of different producers of computers. And at that time, we didn't understand that standards were so important. If we had changed business model from actually producing computers to licensing the design to all kinds of other computer manufacturers, indeed, the world might be Acorn compatible rather than IBM compatible.
Rest in peace, then. Today's dead medium, the BBC microcomputer, accidentally killed in ironic circumstances.
Francis Bufford was our guide to the fateful story of the BBC microcomputer.